Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Monday, October 2nd, 2023. Thank you so much for tuning in. Happy to be here on WVW-TV. We appreciate you watching us. We appreciate your viewership. And of course, many of you are kind and donate additional funds to the foundation to help keep WVTV broadcasting away. We've been on the air since 2006, and we're happy to be able to bring you content from an alternative viewpoints and additional viewpoints, all without a paywall or a subscription or cost. So we do this through kind donors like you yourself as a viewer, and also from sponsors. And of course, I'd like to thank my sponsor, Swiss America Trading, who is a purveyor of precious metals based in Arizona. Now, it's an American company with a great reputation. So if you're looking to add tangible metals to your portfolio, you certainly will want to find a strong partner with a great track record and reputation, and Swiss America fits the bill. You can reach out to them at 1-800-519-6271, ask them for free information, or you can go to their website, SwissAmerica.com, and use the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, and they'll be happy to send you information as well. They are still running a special on those silver walking half dollars, $13.50 all in, including shipping, and that's really a great price. That will last until quantities are gone, of course, until inventory is gone, and they're limited to 250 coins per person. So if you're still thinking about adding silver to your personal portfolio and you're looking for a vendor, give Swiss America a call, 1-800-519-6271. Okay, let's jump into the news for this day and this week. Of course, the big news over the weekend, if you were watching my show last week, and I do apologize, we had some technical difficulties and we had some scheduling difficulties, but we've survived the week and we're off to a fresh start this week. Of course, the big news story is the continuing resolutions that passed the Congress. And of course, there was the threat that the government would shut down on October 1st, which of course was Sunday. And of course, Saturday was the last day. And of course, that was the day the continuing resolution passed by both houses, signed by the president, and kicks the can down the road to November 17th. And of course, what is November 17th? Well, it's the week before Thanksgiving. And if you remember when I started my programming back in March of this year, I was saying, gee, the debt ceiling, we're going to shut the government down. And this usually happens around Christmas time, or at least the holiday season. Well, this is the continuing resolution. And the reason that the government always seems to shut down somewhere between October 1st or, November or December is because these continuing resolutions. And they just basically punted this down the lane, and here we are. They didn't fix anything. They didn't solve anything. What they basically did was pass a resolution that allows, effectively at this point in the year, Janet Yellen to sell additional bonds so that she can raise the money she needs to cover the federal government's obligations, and that's what's happening. So we're not going to go out of business, and I said that last Thursday, I think. I said nothing's going to happen, and I was right. It's just nothing ever happens because Congress is so boxed in to their current spending situation and their current debt situation, the $33 trillion, soon to be $34 trillion, that they can't get out of the box. There's no way at this point anyone in Washington can act with any degree of responsibility. I mean, this is a snowball that is rolled off the top of the mountain, and it's getting to be halfway down, and it's a great big snowball. So off we go with the continuing resolution, and we'll see what happens. Let me just explain this in a little more detail. There are 12 appropriation bills, because the federal government doesn't pass an annual budget bill that sets a budget for the year, and then it matches it to its tax revenues, and then they live on that money. They don't do that. And the federal government is sort of a fascinating creature, because when it was created originally under our Constitution, all of the founders and all of the states believed that the states would be very important. They were states. They were like at the state, these were republic form of government states. They weren't kingdoms, and they weren't dictatorships. They were states. And of course, all of the states had this idea that they would grow and prosper. New York would be prosperous and North Carolina would be prosperous, but that they were really sovereign places. And there was an overhang of a federal government. And that was a great debate after the Revolution. It's, we had the Articles of Confederation. There were just going to be a confederacy of individual powerful states. Well, they started fighting amongst each other, and New York and New Jersey got into a great big tiff about, as people came up the Hudson River, if you turned right or you turned left, they were taxing each other. And then the whole thing was the states were very powerful and egotistical in their own rights. And it was apparent that if 13 states, actually there were 12 plus Vermont or Delaware, which was split off of Pennsylvania, but the point was that if left to their own devices, these states would very soon become very greedy and end up at war with each other. So the idea was, now that we've won our independence from the British, basically by exhausting them, or at least wearing them out, and the British thinking, well, it's better to cut and run. At the end of the American Revolution, we'll deal with that problem later. But as it became apparent to the colonists, now individual statists, that they needed to have some sort of an overreaching mechanism to bring very diverse interests together. And if you think about the American colonies, the 13 original colonies, the Betsy Ross flag with 13 stars and a field of blue, they were very diverse places. If you think about New England, of course, Massachusetts and New Hampshire and Connecticut and Rhode Island were a place. And of course, Maine was a district of Massachusetts, and Vermont really didn't exist. It was sort of this hinterland between New Hampshire and New York, and in the Green Mountains. It was very hard. Nobody lived there, sort of a wasteland until it became part of New England. But the point is, New England was very different. It was very Puritan. They still had, people, you lived in a town, you belonged to the church, you belonged to, the annual meetings, and it was a very, very puritanical place. The mid-Atlantic states were basically economic experiments. They weren't necessarily as religious. I mean, they were very much into wealth. And of course, Maryland was the Catholic place that was basically set up by Lord Baltimore as a Catholic haven in the U.S. or in the New World. And then started drifting into the Episcopalian South with its traditions of agriculture and slavery. So you had these very diverse groups of people that were suddenly independent of the crown. They were basically out there, and they had these little republics with these little states or colonies or former colonies. And at the end of the day, they needed to have some mechanism that would create some logic and also some strength, because, France was not unaware of this vulnerability, even though they had very much engaged in prying these colonies loose from Britain. It wasn't for the benefit of the colonists, it was for the benefit of France, okay? They already had Quebec, and you come out into the Midwest here. There was a very vulnerable time, so these colonists or these new statists really had a need to put together a federal organization that would give them strength so that they could act in a united fashion against the Spanish, who were still in Florida at the time, by the way, and the French, who are our dear best friends, and of course the French participation in the Revolution was, we were all thankful, but we're all a little wary because they controlled New Orleans and basically the Mississippi Valley and Canada above us. And, we were as much surrounded by our friends as our enemies. And of course, the British, they thought, well, if we just take a hiatus, give them their freedom, they'll collapse. We'll be back in 1812 and take them back. See, so all of this was going on. And of course, the people who fought in the American Revolution really believed in their cause. And we're very much smart enough to know that we need to have some sort of a unifying thing so that somebody can't just invade Boston, or you can't invade New York, or you can't invade Charleston. You're going to invade us, not just them. And of course, the Articles of Confederation came first, and that was a real loose confederation, but it really didn't have any authority, and it really didn't have the ability to raise money, and they needed money to provide for a defense of the continent. And this effectively was on every revolutionary colonialist's mind, is how do we defend ourselves not only from the powers of Europe coming west into the shores of now this United America, but we have the Spanish who are notorious for gobbling up lots and lots of spaces, coming pushing from the south, the French pushing from the north, and of course the French and the Indians were always between the poor Indians. They were caught between the French and the British, and they're all scheming, and you know they kind of did all the dirty work there. But at the end of the day, these colonists say, you know what, we have to have an overlay. So the Articles of Confederation fell apart primarily because of the economic structure, and it was replaced by a United States Constitution. And that Constitution was visualized by these colonists as having a strong federal presence for purposes of negotiating with foreign powers, the crowned heads of Europe and others. You'd have a united government, and that we would be able to tax primarily not with income. We didn't have income taxes. We were with duties. It was always this thing about export-import duties and, of course, selling off land, because they want a bunch of land, and if you sell the land off to the settlers and the pioneers, that money goes flowing into the federal treasury. So they use this basically to raise an army to defend our shores, and basically a State Department to negotiate the best deals we could. You know, Benjamin Franklin and all these guys are running around Europe and trying to cut deals. And then we had this platform of defense. And of course, everybody thought, well, this is a good idea to have a navy, because the United States, with its British traditions, and of course, was very, very cognizant of the power of a navy back in the 1700s into the 1800s. And of course, not only did we have a navy, but we had a developing merchant class of the great clipper ships and the East Indian trade and the China trade and all of the ability with our seafaring knowledge to become very effective in seafaring trade. So as this Constitution came together, nobody was imagining that the federal government would be anything other than a servant to the states, to protect the states as a group, allowing the states to grow, and effectively taking in duties to protect the coastline and, you know, the wilderness. Or even, you know, remember George Washington was a surveyor running around and, you know, in the West trying to figure out where what did we just win and where did it start and start and what's out there. So it was a simple time. And I guess, you know, we say, well, we live in a modern complex society, which is all different. But the reality is the simple concept that a federal government was effectively a collective effort by the states to protect themselves so the states could prosper and grow. And of course, we had this terrifically bad debate within the country. The northern areas, the New England areas with their Puritan traditions, and the mid-Atlantic states were very, very much against the slavery idea. It rubbed people the wrong way. There's something wrong about having this free and independent America, but you got a bunch of people that are slaves. It was counterintuitive. So in order to get this Constitution in place, this federal government in place, people had to compromise, and that's basically what happened. And the compromise was that slavery continued in the South. And of course, from the Southern perspective, when you think about how plantations were organized, and you think about old feudal Europe, if the king gave you a grant as a knight, or maybe as a duke, or, you know, more modern as a duke, you received a whole big pile of territory with people living on it. And those people were effectively in servitude or serfdom, where they held their little parcel to the duke, and they had to pay a fee upstairs. And then the duke, of course, had to pay up to the king. So this whole mindset of a great big piece of land with people on it, and all happily, you know, they're not happy, nobody's ever happy, working away with the idea that everybody generates economics and it all trickles upstairs, was feudalism for 1,200 plus years in Europe, maybe even 1,800 years, depending if you look at Russia. But you simply didn't work in the United States because there was no upstairs. There wasn't a king. We just kicked the king out. Now these guys have these big plantations. They're making money, exploiting people. And it was a disaster. So the point is, when we look at our federal government, nobody ever envisioned that it would become a thing that would confiscate 35%, 40% of your income, everybody's income. And it would become a thing unto itself with its own operating procedures, its own staffing, its own agenda. It has become a nation a federal government has become a nation that is effectively detached from the states. And it's kind of peculiar that when you think about Washington, D.C., it's a district of Columbia. And of course, in the beginning, they didn't want any one state to have this federal capital, because that would make that state very powerful. So the founders said, you know what, we're going to take some Baltimore, Virginia, and cut out the square, and we're going to separate it. So it's not in any state. It's just a district. It's common to all of the states, okay? We took territory away. We said, okay, this box, if you look at the map, it's a square. This is going to be, you know, a place unto itself. And that's what Washington, D.C. is. It is its own nation. And you know, there's some interesting economic and I guess sort of more of the conspiratorial folks that will say that how interesting it is that Washington, D.C. is its own place. It's not even a state. It's not even a state in the Union. And London is its own city because, you know, even the Queen, or I guess King Charles, now, like, they have to, the monarch has to ask permission to enter London. Are you kidding? Get my palace sitting there. I got to ask permission to go in. And the same thing with the Vatican. And, you know, this gets conspiratorial. And this is a financial report, okay? But the point is, the federal government in the United States has become a nation unto itself. And it's, there's more and more argument that the United States of America federal government is detaching itself from the 50 states. And when you look at what it has done with this $33, soon to be $34 trillion in debt that it has racked up, in addition to taxing all the people in the 50 states, they take all the tax money and then they blow $33 trillion more, then this becomes a real issue as to what is going on in Washington. And when we think about it as a nation, it becomes really concerning that this federal thing is out of control and it's not responsive to the people. And yet it's populated by famous people from all over the country. Nancy Pelosi from California. I never voted for anybody named Nancy Pelosi other than Wisconsin. Chuck Schumer from New York. Nobody around here has ever voted for anybody named Chuck Schumer. I got to tell you. All these people become celebrities. AOC, all these people are celebrities, and they have the ability to not only tax the American state citizens into oblivion, but to regulate them and then to spend money in such a way that it becomes reckless, that you have this idea that you can rack up $33 trillion in debt. Now, there's some interesting structure about the federal government's ability, at least the philosophy, that it has to have the freedom to react because there's global crises and nuclear bombs and terrorists and all this stuff, that they have the ability to spend beyond their means. And if they didn't have that ability, they would have to tax people to the point where the United States, the states would collapse because all the money gets sucked out of the 50 states to Washington in this very large tax burden, and then they spend remarkably more. If you look at the spend, $1.6 trillion is projected to be the deficit for 2024, which started yesterday. Today is the second, yesterday was the first. I mean, spending $1.6 trillion, and it's not like we're in a national emergency where, you know, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor or, you know, the Russians nuked something. No, this is just ongoing gift spending, totally detached from the ability of the American economy to pay for this stuff, and they keep going. And what they do, they just sell debt. So if you can imagine your family, and you had a salary, let's say you made $100,000 a year, okay, gross household income. That's, you know, that's kind of getting to be where the average is. And your burn rate, your family was spending $500,000 a year, and you're only bringing in $100,000. And this is, of course, half of that goes to the federal government, okay? So you're really living on $50,000, even though they, you make $100,000 working at this business, and your take-home pay is $50,000. Well, where'd the rest of it go? Well, you got the federal government, you got Social Security, you got the state taxes, you got local taxes, you got gasoline taxes, you got... So the point is, if you were like spending $500,000 a year and you're bringing home $50,000, at some point your creditors will cut you off, and that can't happen with the federal government. Nobody can cut them off because they just keep printing more bonds and selling more bonds and taking in more money. And that's why when you see this continuing resolution passed, it was very interesting to me because it happened on the last day of the month. Now, oftentimes they run in for a week or 10 days, and then the poor air traffic controllers don't get their paycheck, and the government workers, they go on furlough, they don't get their money paid back to them when the government kicks in again. But it didn't happen this time. And I thought to myself, you know, at some point, when you get close enough to the edge, you have to deal with that continuing resolution. And they didn't punt it into a 10-day window and then play politics and everybody's shaking their fists. My sense is that this is starting to get really, really serious, that we've got a federal government where the Democrats will sit there. This is not a political show, but it's you know, from a perspective of an investor, you know, you look at it and you say, the Democrats are sitting there smiling and Republicans are at each other's throats. And you got the conservative caucus that wants to cut out funding for Ukraine. And you got the mainstream Republicans who never, ever pass up on an opportunity to waste more federal dollars. They win elections based on cutting the budget, balancing the budget, cutting taxes. Then they go to Washington and turn that spigot on so fast. So the point is, this is a very interesting thing. And part of the purpose of the show, of course, is to read between the lines and start to develop these critical thinking skills. And the real takeaway was they passed this continuing resolution on the last day, given all the pressures that are going on. Even Joe Biden, you know, somebody must have moved his hand, they signed the bill. And so, you know, we've got until November 17th, like I said, which is just before Thanksgiving. We're going to listen to this whole show. And you know what's going to happen? I'll tell you right now. I don't want you to be in suspense until November 17th. I'll just tell you. Nothing's going to happen. It's just going to continue. And all of that overhang is going to be more and more and more of a burden on the U.S. economy. I mean, at some point, we're 330 million people. We're not 1.5 billion like the Chinese or the East Indians. There's only 330 million of us. Half of us don't pay taxes. And at the end of the day, at some point, you have... You've drained the well. The well's gone dry, and I think this is interesting. So anyway, they need 8 more appropriation bills to pass to fund 2024. They don't pass a budget. They don't pass a budget bill like the states do. And it's going to, you know, this. And if you break it all up and vote on that, but you know, it's very easy to do because there's no accountability. And then, of course, the 12 appropriation bills, which are the standard right now, have to pass both the House and the Senate and be signed by the president. There's lots of argument going on there. And at the end, you know, there's no agreement on total spending for 2024. There never, ever is. So there's no energy, there's no emergency, there's no crisis, and there's no ability to balance a budget. You'd think if there was a crisis, you know, you could run a deficit. Hey, we've been invaded, let's run a deficit and defend ourselves. This is daily spending. This is like you spending 10 times more than you bring home. And there's no crisis just because you like your lifestyle where it is. And I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch. But that's why when at the end of the day, the states at some point are going to have to react to an out of control federal government that is not only demanding with respect to federal regulations to make, you know, America homogenous from sea to shining sea when it comes to gas stoves and, you know, how big your wash machine is. That's real important. But at the end of the day, you know, who are we invading next? You know, we were in Afghanistan for 20 years and we came home with our tail tucked between our legs and left, you know, billions of dollars of equipment. And then there's Syria and then there's Ukraine. I mean, it just goes on and on and on for what? And that's the question that I think, you know, if you're looking at political risk in an investment environment, Americans have to be thinking about political risk. And you see this more and more in the mainstream financial press. People are finally waking up to this idea. Wow. You know, first you have to figure out how to count to $33 trillion. And I tell you, if I stood here and handed you a dollar bill every second, it'd be 56,800 years to do one. I'm going to do it 33 times now. It's a lot of money. But people are starting to get their heads around that. You know, why are houses so expensive? You know, I saw a story, 99% of Americans can no longer afford to buy a house. 99, I mean, nobody. nobody, if you have a house, you're in good shape, because, you know, a rising tide floats all boats, and inflation, for all this fiddling with the interest rates, you know, that's not going to do it. You're in a good shape. If you don't own a house right now, man, I keep you in my prayers, because that would be, if you want to get laser focused on doing something for your own future benefit, this would be a real good time to figure out a way to get in somehow, get on that escalator. And you can see that with the private equity guys going all over these communities and buying up these houses, you know, on the cheap, and then doing minimal work, renting them out. You're seeing even rental units, you know, communities in our part of the world are saying, we've got to do something about affordable housing. So they approve these great big apartment complexes, and they're all renting at $3,000 a month. Well, let me tell you something. If on an American salary, and you're paying $3,000 post-tax dollars a month for rent, you have there's no equity. And equity is the only thing that grows with inflation. So you really need to be revisiting. Now, maybe, you know, there's health reasons or physical reasons, or not everybody can own a home, but it begs the question from a policy perspective, how can you have 99% of Americans that can't afford to buy a house? I mean, back in the old days, we had, you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, you know, all the house programs, the housing programs, even the ag department got in on housing programs. And today, it's like, that's not important. What's important is we've got to spend all this money over in Ukraine and interfering with basically a civil war between Slavic peoples, and stimulating that mess instead of letting it cool down. But what about all the people in America? And I think that's a real problem. The federal government is just simply tone deaf when it comes to this. So I talked to my guy, my representative, and there's nothing you can do. It's just, you go there, put your hand up, put your hand down, come back to the district, tell everybody, oh, we're going to stop those immigrants from coming in. You know, great. You know, actually, you should let them in. We're going to need people to pay 90% of their income to support the federal blowout here. So anyway, you know, it's a typical problem with the federal situation we're in. And of course, when you look at this, how it trickles down to the people, I'm watching very carefully this student loan problem. We're starting to see it in my community, my neighborhood. There are just a whole lot of people that are starting their adulthood and, you know, owning homes or wishing they could buy homes, and then having hundreds of dollars a month and student loan debt service kicking in, which is having a really, really detrimental effect on basically the entertainment and restaurant industries. Movie theaters are closing, and man, restaurants, that's a tough business to be in right now, because the discretionary spending necessary for the luxury of having somebody bring you a hot meal is simply becoming unattainable for more and more people. Yet at the same time, when you look at, you know, the elite restaurants with the people that are making money, you know, remember my three silos? Well, the people in the rich silo, you got the poor, the middle class, and the rich. You know, the folks in the rich silo are just doing wonderfully. I mean, interest rates are up. You can earn 5% on your money in a CD at a bank. You don't have any risk, well, to speak of. But at the end of the day, for the middle class, which is shrinking, and the poor silo, which unfortunately is expanding, this is not going to play well. And I think that, you know, these ideas of, you know, the next election cycle is becoming a very frustrating thing, because it's not solving the problems. I can elect, you know, my current congressman, or I can elect somebody else, but you go to that machine, once, you know, when you're the newbie, or you're lower on the federal totem pole, and you get to Washington, that's what my guy will tell you. He said, man, you know, it'll take you 30 years to become anybody in Washington. And then when you're somebody, it's because you're beholden to everybody. So there's really not a solution. So effectively, when you look at this federal government on its own piece of land floating around, they say, oh, we want to make Washington, D.C. the 51st state, so we get two more Democratic senators and one more House representative, and we'll change the balance of power. That's likely not to happen, because at the end of the day, it's a world unto itself. And the problem is, it's no different than colonialism. You think about London in the 1600s and 1700s owning the world. You know, money flowed in. So anyway, I'm out of time. Keep an eye on Congress, see what they're up to, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in. Bye.